Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Maxine McHugh makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's extremely well known, so I'll be very brief in introducing her. On the occasion of the recent launch of Tales from the Political Trenches by Maxine McHugh, she's the Vice-Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Melbourne. She also works as an advisor on education to the not-for-profit group Social Ventures Australia and is a member of the board of Per Capita. Of course, Maxine McHugh had a distinguished career in journalism on the ABC and elsewhere, and won the seat of Bennelong in 2007, which she held until 2010. And during that period, Ms. McHugh served as a parliamentary secretary. But she's here today as an author, and the topic for the talk is Tales from the Political Trenches. Maxine McHugh, you're very welcome.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Gerard, and good evening, everyone. It's nice to see you here. And could I acknowledge my former colleague, Robert McClellan? Nice to see you here, Robert. Well, the Sydney Institute is a lovely place to return to, an important temple of ideas, as I say. Not the only one, but certainly a very, very important one in this city. And that's really my theme, the contest of ideas. And its current substitute, the contest of fears, is actually the theme that runs through my book, Tales from the Political Trenches. Tony Abbott, as many of you realise, actually very nearly made Labor a one-term government at the last federal election on the back of an exceptionally negative, fearful campaign. Stop the boats, end the waste, etc., etc. We all remember it. And on my side of the political divide, we've had, as Tony Walker captured in a quote in the Australian Financial Review last weekend, recently the class war, the gender war, and perhaps the religious war. I hope not. My favourite lines in my book actually have nothing to do with the much publicised events of June 22, which of course led to the removal of a first-term Prime Minister. But my favourite lines are from a quote from a note, actually, sent to me by a very distinguished Australian after I won in Bennelong. It was a note sent by the former Chief Justice of the High Court, Sir Gerard Brennan. Now, Sir Gerard gave me permission to reproduce his words. And his note was very idealistic. It expressed the hope that with the political change at the end of 2007, that this would mark, as he said, the dawn of a new age, an age in which Australia may again become a confident nation, in which fear and negativity have no place. Well, if there is a tone of disappointment in my book, and that's not all there is, but there is disappointment in this book, it's because I think we're all still waiting for that new age. And here we are, a privileged people, in a country that is blessed in every way, a rich inheritance and really a limitless future, but for the most part, I think a political class that seems incapable of celebrating this. I was at a recent conference at Melbourne University just in the last couple of weeks, organised by the Australia India Institute, and it brought together a lot of marvellous Indian delegates from academe, from politics, from business. And at the dinner the night before the conference started, so many of the Indian delegates said to us, "What is it you Australians are so neurotic about? What have you got to be worried about?" Now, of course, it's a most interesting perspective when you consider the scale of the challenges facing modern India. But, you know, in today's Australia, I think we seem stuck. We yell at each other, and our public debate is therefore more shrill than sane. No insult seems too extreme, and success is measured in terms of minor tactical advantage. Our public discourse is crude, and as a result, our politics feels thin. The powerful don't want to be challenged. We're still playing divide and rule, and the political class has an almost lordly contempt for all views that don't fit the neat script that is dreamt up by communications minders at 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, the great regret I have is actually for the opportunity. It's not too late, but it's the opportunity that I feel that to this point Labor has missed. And that's the opportunity to lift, to inspire, to say, what is the best we can be? To look at the way Australia is changing and to speak to a new set of ambitions and challenges. Now, I know a lot of people say that's impossible in our modern media-driven world, the conflict-driven media culture. Or maybe we've just given up. But I've absolutely no doubt that there is an appetite for genuine engagement. It's the issue that comes up at events such as this, as I've been going around the country promoting my book. And you'll forgive the outrageous boast. Tales is now number two on the independent sellers book list, and number two on the Dimmocks list. Interestingly, it's ahead of. I will pay for this moment of hubris. Interestingly, it's ahead of one of my favourites, Hilary Mantel's "Bring Up the Bodies," but it's just below. Can anyone guess what number one is at the moment? Shades of Grey. No. Think independent. Number one. No, I'm above her. Isn't that amazing? I'm above her. Number one is Jamie Oliver's 15-minute meals. There you go. So, cooking before coups, but coups ahead of beheadings. As someone said to me last night, I was at an event in Camberwell in Melbourne, someone said, just stick a few recipes in and you'll go up to number one. My point is this. The field is actually wide open for leadership that I think will leapfrog the current banalities and give us something better. Now, I am hopeful. I'm always hopeful, and I'm an optimist, as you can probably tell. With the Prime Minister's recent announcement of that all-important Asian Century white paper, that actually this is the issue or the set of issues that can actually give us a sense of national purpose. But that will only happen if there is sustained advocacy and integrated policy making, a match of the rhetoric with the reality. It has to be more than a 24-hour wonder. In the concluding chapter of my book, I quote someone who's an old friend, but a very reliable source, Rod Cameron, the founder of ANOP Polling. He makes the point that Labor needs to combine the priorities of a progressive party with the values and aspirational outlook of suburban families and small business. He says, Labor needs to communicate a vision and inspiration to an increasingly whinging electorate and needs leadership which can successfully translate national goals to individual relevance. This would restore a level of confidence to an electorate unnecessarily gloomy and despondent. He goes on to argue for a lift in the standard of public discourse and behaviour in order to reconnect with the electorate, which is past cynicism, as he says. But above all, he says what's needed is leadership that stands for something, anything other than a platitude or slogan. Leadership that combines values, ideology, and national priorities. Now, you might have noticed that Labor has lifted off the mat, and that's a good thing. But, you know, it's largely on the back of very effective negative targeting of Tony Abbott. Now, on our side, you might say, well, that's sweet justice, because Tony Abbott has brought his party to a winning position, largely on the strength of a very negative stance against the Prime Minister and, indeed, the Labor government. Now, depressingly, I have no doubt that both sides are going to continue in this vein. The personal attacks work, as the slogans and insults reinforce existing voter discomfort with both sides. So if you think that the last federal election in 2010 was moronic, as I did, I think, and I've got a very bad feeling about the next one. But I've also, as I say, got no doubt that voters want something more, at the very least, a national conversation that treats them like grown-ups. And this is not just a fantasy on my part. Ipsos Mackay's social researcher, Dr. Rebecca Huntley, has been consistently recording in her mood mind surveys conducted across the country that nostalgia for the high expectations generated in 2007 and concern about the lack of the planning for the country's future are high on voters' minds. And I notice well that Dr. Huntley was quoted again last weekend making the point that Julia Gillard's negative tactics against Tony Abbott could end up being self-defeating. She said, "The Prime Minister has a limited time to talk to people, and she deprives herself of space and oxygen to talk about the reasons why they should vote for the government, regardless of who the opposition leader is. It's crucial to get people to re-engage in what the PM has to say. It's not enough to target the opposition leader." So what is it that we need to talk about? Well, first of all, there's the not insubstantial question of how we fund the federal budget and pay for the things that we need in a time of slower growth and falling revenues. Now, consider the challenge highlighted by the mid-year budget figures. We now have more taxes, but our overall tax take is down from 25% of GDP to around 21%. If we look at just one of these issues, the minerals resource rent tax, and of course, as you know, this was the most potent issue that played out all the way up until Rudd's removal in 2010. As I highlight in my book, this issue could have been resolved differently had there been greater internal contestability around the design of the tax and a lot more thorough consultation with all the stakeholders and particularly with the resource-rich state of WA. But where are we at on this issue? Well, revenues from the revised MRRT will deliver $4 billion less than projected over the forward estimates, and the big resource companies to date have no liabilities. State royalties are still in place. And if you keep in mind that the then Treasury Secretary, Ken Henry's idea, was that, of course, we would have a simplification of all of this. State royalties would be abolished. But they are still in place, and there's an incentive almost for the states to increase those royalties. And the Commonwealth is required to rebate coal and iron ore producers against the MRRT liability. That reduces, of course, the net tax take to the Commonwealth. The corporate tax rate is still 30%, not the 25% as Ken Henry originally proposed. So the key question that arises from all of this is, was it worth doing? Can we call it taxation reform? Certainly, the Committee of Review of GST Distribution has made the point that in the long term, this tax, the MRRT, is not sustainable. The whole process has hardly been a model of effective policy making, and it's left the business community pretty jaundiced and unwilling, I think, to consider the whole question of repairing the tax base. If the government's goals around productivity enhancement and investment in education, skills and infrastructure are to be met, and with major items, as you know, like the NDIS and the Gonski funding formula for schools on Labor's agenda, then some very difficult decisions are going to have to be taken about spending priorities and how we enhance the tax mix. Slogans and attack campaigns will not help us with the scale of the problem solving required. At the same time, as many people have been pointing out, federalism is creaking, precisely at the time when cooperation with the states has never been more important. You can hear the frustration in Nick Greiner's voice when he says the COAG process is well and truly bogged down. Everyone agrees between the different levels on the principle, whether it's education, whether it's disability care or whatever, but literally within minutes of the agreement being signed, it breaks down into a puerile argument about who is going to pay. It was also no surprise to see Griffith University's recent survey of Australian voter attitudes to how we're governed, which recorded declining confidence in our ability to achieve long-term reform across the jurisdictions. I know this is an issue that's bedeviled us for a long time, but we've got to make progress on this one. Now, one other area that I would nominate where we need a sensible grown-up discussion is around education. I find it a really depressing comment on the Times that those individuals who spent over a year of their time and effort reporting on the importance of an equitable funding mix for our schools, David Gonski, Carmen Lawrence, Ken Boston and Catherine Greiner, purely out of a sense of civic-mindedness, have had to watch as some have attempted to turn the whole issue into yet another low-rent argument about how many dollars might be taken off a few privileged schools. All of the data tells us that there is an unacceptable 2 to 3 year learning gap between our most privileged students and our most disadvantaged students. We also know that Labor's substantial investment in low SES schools through the national partnership agreements with the states has yielded results. Academic achievement is lifting. It is patchy, but discernible. But I think the government's been too quiet about what is really a heroic story. Principals and lead teachers in some of our poorest schools raising standards, boosting expectation, and demanding the best from students and from parents. Equally, I find it bewildering that the Labor government has left Gonski to the tail end of the political cycle. It suggests, I think, quite a gap between rhetoric and commitment. The tardiness on Gonski, I think, is in actually marked contrast to the very speedy embrace, you might remember in the middle of the year, of Angus Houston's review of asylum seeker policy. Very different, I know. But I noted that Cabinet, the Labor caucus and Parliament dealt with all of that inside a week. An interesting set of priorities. Excuse me. If the Asian Century White Paper is about anything, it's about investment in our brain power. And that's how I see it, an investment, not a cost. At some point, mining revenues will diminish, and by then we will want to be sure that other parts of the economy are doing more of the heavy lifting. It's through investment in research, in many cases at our top institutions, that we will see the benefits of greater diversification in our economy and, in time, transformation. More of our universities are now recognised in the top global rankings, and this in turn is what attracts top talent to Australia and creates a virtuous circle that boosts research and innovation. But again, consider a recent decision in the mid-year review and how it runs, I think, a bit counter to this goal. Having finally won the argument in 2010 to have the infrastructure costs associated with university research funded on a co-contribution basis by the federal government, the recent budget review reversed this decision. Nearly $500 million was taken out of the university's SRE program, thus returning us to this stop-start short-termism that many of you will know has always bedeviled research in this country. Not a smart decision. We'd be far better off, I think, with considered investment in education in all areas rather than bonuses. I've got a particular beef about the $2 billion for the school kids bonus that we saw announced in the May budget, which to my mind is just the kind of expense we can no longer afford. It adds to the entitlement mentality, it doesn't win a vote, and it robs us, I think, of the productivity enhancement that we do need. One other area that I'll nominate where I think it's time for a contest of ideas concerns foreign policy. Everyone seems to have a heart attack when Paul Keating emerges every now and then, as he did just last week, and makes a substantial speech and questions, inevitably, the status quo. But as you'll tell, if you've read my book, certainly the beginning chapter starts with an extended conversation with Paul Keating, and I always enjoy my chats with him and his thinking. I think it's because he's an intelligent provocateur. Interestingly, Bob Carr, our foreign minister, responded somewhat sympathetically and agreed with the former prime minister that too often, when it comes to our relationship with Indonesia, it has tended to be dominated by all of these other issues, like whether it's cattle exports or asylum seekers, when there are so many important other things. Certainly, I wonder if we fully appreciate the vibrancy and the capacity of a country that has so successfully and so recently embraced democratic norms. In his Keith Murdoch oration in Melbourne last week, Keating also declared that the era of Australian foreign policy activism had passed. Well, I don't agree with that one, because I would certainly point to Australia's inclusion and direct involvement with the G20, very, very important, and our recent win in gaining one of the rotating seats on the UN Security Council. I think they stand as important points of evidence of successful and sustained advocacy in international fora. Equally, I'm all for maintaining the strongest possible engagement with the United States through our historic alliance. But, you know, I think Keating is prompting us to think more about future decisions that will be in our national interest. And yes, of course, there'll be questions about China and its sphere of influence. But more important, I wonder what we have learnt from following America as an alliance partner into two long wars, a very long war in Afghanistan, and of course one in Iraq. We don't even debate this, and I doubt it was mentioned at the recent Osmin talks in Perth. But it seems to me that if we are to have what Paul Keating called an enlightened sense of self, then we need to analyse the recent past and ask whether, again, it was worth it. And under what circumstances would Australia once again invade countries far from our borders, where we become bogged down, as I say, for more than a decade in the case of Afghanistan, and where the outcome looks highly problematic? I think that's worth debating. That's a contest of ideas. But again, it is unlikely that is going to be something that will feature in the coming election campaign. Now, I've made some very harsh judgments in my book about Labor, about my side of politics, and it's because I want Labor to be better. I want the country to be better. The Labor government is now at the 5-year mark, and while there have been many good policy initiatives and many legislative wins through this period of minority government, I think it's also fair to say that most Australians would still struggle to nominate the key distinguishing features of Labor's period in government. What is it that defines this period? We know there's barely a shred of bipartisanship and very little unity across key constituent groups, business, trade unions, and community groups. Now, I compare this with the 5-year mark of the Hawke-Keating period, where in spite of a very difficult external environment, there was, I think, widespread understanding about the government's central purpose: the liberalising of the economy and the maintenance of a targeted social safety net. John Howard, as the leader of the opposition for much of that period, in the main supported the government's reformist agenda. And by contrast, today I think we see little agreement across the policy spectrum, whether it's to do with the pricing of carbon, the taxation of our resources, equity in education, or broadband policy. We're in very different times, and I think the nation is the poorer for that, because our leaders are seemingly incapable of finding at least some areas of common agreement and, at the same time, of lifting the national spirit. In describing my own motivation for making the switch from journalism to politics, from being a questioner for so many years to someone who wanted to work on the answers, I would emphasise this. I was never cynical about politics. And as grim as some of the revelations that are coming out of the current ICAC hearings here in New South Wales, it's still true. I retain a basic respect for the endeavour. Most people in politics are there for the right reasons. Through many years of interviewing international and national figures, I learned to recognise what I admire most in effective leaders: the call to service, the extraordinary physical and intellectual effort that it actually requires, and those who have the wit at some point to junk the conventional. This is how I describe some of the things I considered, and if you like, the climate that was very different when I was reporting on politics, certainly in the late 80s and 90s when I came back from a period of reporting in the United States. I say this, my starting point was that the modern Australian success story had not just happened. It had been argued and fought over and knocked into shape by a generation of political players. The best of them had the boldness and the energy to reimagine the country through an altered policy mix that boosted our competitiveness without overt damage to the nation's social fabric. And it didn't happen without pain. But it did happen, substantially without rancour and division, because at a critical point in time, a group of senior journalists had the wit and the gravitas to analyse and explain the way Australia was changing. People like Paul Kelly, Max Walsh, Laurie Oakes, Kerry O'Brien and Michelle Grattan always kept the pressure on the political class, pinning them down on detail and exposing the inconsistencies, but at the heart of their work was an honesty about the need to promote a contestable and civil public discourse. I go on to say that that was what made a big impression on me. But I also make the point, of course, that this now sounds arcane, doesn't it? We now live with a media politics dynamic that is almost, as I say, completely conflict-driven, and it chews up a lot in its path. George Megalogenis, the author of The Australian Moment, said recently, a politician is now more likely to begin a chat with a journalist these days by saying, "How do you think we're doing?" Meaning, of course, how are we going in the polls? And he said, by contrast, he can remember a time when Australian leaders would start a conversation by telling you where they were going. And I still puzzle over this. It is not that Canberra lacks the intellectual firepower. When I arrived as a newbie at the end of 2007, I encountered no end of bright people, people who are energetic, who are conscientious, and as I say, most of them there for the right reason, because they want to serve. But I do think that the prevailing media and political culture rewards banality and repetition and inhibits creativity and originality. The key performance indicators, the KPIs, all seem to revolve around volume. Announcements, doorstops, point scoring on Sky News and numbers of social media hits. Robert knows what I'm talking about, and he would have found it as tiresome as I did. Now, I am finding that a lot of people are responding to the parts of my book where I describe what I call the command and control system of the communications teams, the message masters who are now more powerful in the senior offices than the policymakers. And this is true for both sides of politics. How am I going for time? I've got another seven minutes? Okay. Now, I have to say to you on this point, my friends in the media find no end of amusement in me saying this, that, of course, with a 30-year background in communications, that as a new MP, I was the one who struggled with this. You know, everyone, I guess, assumed that I would get this right. But I will just read a short section here of exactly how frustrating I found this, because I did not handle, if you like, my own communications particularly well, and I kind of fell foul of the operational mindset. This is what I say here. Some days I felt like the problem child who needed to be disciplined after class. One of Julia Gillard's media acolytes testily told me one day to work on my exits. Come again? Apparently I was a bit tardy about making a quick getaway at the end of press conferences held on locations, usually at a childcare centre or a school, where you were required to break the land speed record and escape into an already accelerating Commonwealth car. God forbid that you might linger and try and explain a policy point or two to gathered journalists. My staff were told on numerous occasions that the trouble with your boss is that she still thinks like a journalist. Too right I did. I certainly had changed professions, but I hadn't left my analytical skills behind. So I always ran a critical eye over the daily missives that poured out of the senior officers. The ubiquitous talking points represented the script that all MPs were supposed to memorise and reproduce. The plucky few who were called on to swell a scene or two in front of the cameras on each and every day of a parliamentary sitting week were required to A, look straight ahead and speak with empathy to Labour's working families, and B, to pulverise the opposition for their shocking neglect and callous disregard for anyone but themselves. It turns out I wasn't the only renegade team player who thought that this was a crazy way for a government to communicate. As one of my colleagues, and someone who had been in politics for a very long time, said to me, when I turn on Sky TV and see a string of our backbenchers all saying the same expletive words that have been approved for that day, I just feel a kind of despair, because you know no one knows what they're talking about. There's just no connection with the real world. And I go on to say that, in fact, this is one of the things that is contributing, I think, to the dumbing down of our democracy. I would also add, it seems to be accompanied by a high level of intolerance towards those who express any disquiet with this kind of governance. You may have noticed Dr. Jennifer Westacott recently, the head of the Business Council of Australia. She made a speech, very important one I thought, about governance, where she said that there were too many political gatekeepers actually getting in the way of ministerial effectiveness. Perfectly valid point. But almost within hours, she was being briefed against by people in the PM's office, and surprise, surprise, that little email found its way onto the front page of The Australian. But I notice, well, this issue won't go away. Terry Moran, the former head of the Office of Prime Minister and Cabinet and now president of the Institute of Public Administration, has also made the point that there's now a significant problem with accountability by ministerial advisers. Moran has said that the old conventions governing the roles of advisers no longer hold true, and that there are now too few who actually possess a good grasp of the business of government, such as that is commensurate with their responsibilities. No one, he says, can any more assume that advisers are an expression of the persona of their ministers. An important point. I'll just conclude by saying a few things about, I guess, the wilder reactions to my book. I want to put to bed once and for all of you, held by a few, and I stress only a few, that I had some malign intent in writing this book. I write for the same reason as any other writer, and that's to understand. And in taking the time to look back and reflect on my own professional experiences, and certainly the period that marked the return of Labor to office at the end of 2007, what I've aimed to do is to put together a coherent, I hope readable, explanation of some of the more dramatic events in our recent political history. I went where the research took me. Over the past year, I have spent hours talking with and recording the comments of former colleagues, staffers, and in some cases, bureaucrats. Now, it's a complex story and deserving of something a little more nuanced than the fairy tale that I think has been told by the head of the AWU and others. As a journalist, I spent years interviewing prime ministers. In 2007, I went out to beat one of the country's outstanding political warriors, John Howard, in a seat that he had held for 33 years. Convention suggested that I could not pull it off. But 3 years later, I was actually witness to a very brutal breach of convention when a first-term prime minister was removed. Not because he was found guilty of any propriety, but because he refused to let Labor's power brokers, the people who feel they own the party, run his government. And that's what I call a story worth telling. I reject entirely the ludicrous idea that there's only one eternal truth about why Rudd was removed, and of course, then that's the version told by those who moved against him. As I've said repeatedly since the publication of my book, winners get to write the first draft of history. But the vanquished also have their stories, and they deserve to be heard. I know that my book has caused discomfort for some, but it has been welcomed by many others and by many within the Australian Labor Party, which I believe is old enough and robust enough to withstand a fresh look at the exceptional events of 2010. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
So we come to questions and discussion, and we finish no later than 7 o'clock, which gives us plenty of time. I should say that, firstly, I should say thanks to King & Wood Mellisons for the use of this great room tonight with this wonderful view, and also that Janet Grundy's got some copies of Tales from the Political Trenches, and I'm sure that Maxine McHugh would be happy to sign them.
No.
After the event. Well, I'm sure she would. And so we come to questions and discussion. Just talk us through a little bit about your personal experiences. You had an unusual transition into politics in the sense that you didn't go in as a minister as a few people do, or as a backbencher as most people do, but you sort of go in pretty well as a parliamentary secretary, which is a bit limiting because you can't ask questions and you can't answer questions, and you're not a minister, but you're not a backbencher. And I think it's fair to say from looking at your book that you work well with Kevin Rudd and you found Julie Gillard difficult. But do you think you would have had a different perspective on life had you gone in as a backbencher or as a minister rather than your unusual role as a parliamentary secretary?
No, that's a good question. I have reflected in times. Perhaps it should have been. It might have been an easier transition if I actually opted to go on the back bench. But I have to say the surprise and the thrill of the win didn't really make that possible. I think if Rudd had not given me something, it would have been seen, certainly by the people of Bennelong, actually, as a massive slight. I should remind everyone to say that people in Bennelong had enormous pride in the fact that they were represented by the Prime Minister. And for many years at the same time, they were also represented at the state level by a Deputy Premier in John Watkins. So there was a bit of a, well, you know, if I never said anything, but of course there was this bit of an expectation. So, as I say, I went in at the PALSEC level. I actually think, Jared, the problems I encountered were in part I did not join a faction, and that had been a deliberate choice. Whenever I was asked during the campaign, and of course nobody took any notice because most people did not expect me to win. As I say, the conventional wisdom that I might take a percentage point or two off John Howard, but that I would fall short and, you know, have to pick it up in a subsequent by-election. Some that you would know very well, I saw in Melbourne recently, Petro Giorgio said, "Don't you realise that, in fact, if John Howard had retained his seat in 2007, he would still be in the Parliament. He would not have left." I hadn't actually thought of that. I must have said on four occasions when people asked me if I'm going to Canberra as a member of the Australian Labor Party, as a member of anything else, Emily's List or any other, you know, subgrouping. And, look, I think that meant it was a bit of a lonely place to be. What I needed to do was develop other alliances with other like-minded people, and I did that to a certain extent. And certainly, if I'd had the fortune to get back in the second term, I would have done more of that. But look, the party is very, very not just factional but tribal, and I have to say that I think some of the problems I encountered. You see, I didn't. It's not so much the difficulty I had with the Deputy Prime Minister's office, but we're very, very different. It was perfectly understandable that Julia Gillard would have seen me as a political accident. When in fact politics is her life. And she is absolutely grounded in that. So I was a very, very different creature, and I understand those, as I say, those tribal differences. Notwithstanding that many of you would know, my partner, you know, has been in the Labor Party all his life. But I was a bit different because of the manner of my coming into the Parliament, and also because I have to say I wasn't always quiet about my views on some of the campaigning techniques that we continued in government, and I do think that was a mistake. I've mentioned this to Kevin Rudd on a number of occasions, and I think we handicapped ourselves by rushing a lot of things and by, as I say, hanging on to the language that was perfectly appropriate for a campaign. And, you know, you require those disciplined messages and all the rest of it. But we needed something more sophisticated in government. We certainly needed it after we executed what I consider to be a brilliant, you know, passage through the global financial crisis. But we never claimed the victory. And as I said on election night, 2010, I think it was one of our central problems. We allowed these, you know, ridiculous claims by Tony Abbott to go almost uncontested about out-of-control debt and all the rest of it, which is just rubbish. If any of you look at, you know, the situation in North America or in Europe. So I think the difficulties I found were to do with some of these other issues.
So we'll go down to the back. Yeah.
In relation to your education comments, do you think that it's time for Australia to adopt a secular model of education? And if it fails to do that, do you think it will retard the quality of the education system and also retard the intellectual development of the nation?
Well, as a product of Catholic schooling, no, I would always defend the importance of faith-based education. The critical issue, as I see it in education, is our equity gap. It's the work I was involved with last year with Social Ventures Australia. It was the work I was involved with early childhood. It's extraordinary, actually, that given the excellence of our schooling system, and it's highly we do very well in on international scales in terms of achievement, but when we start to look, as I say, at the difference between, our bright and middle students and those in our low SES schools, and I'm talking about low SES schools, not in remote areas, not in Central Australia or Northern Territory, but in our big urban centres, 20, 30 minutes from the CBD. And I'm also not talking about, refugee children, newly arrived settlers. In some cases, we're talking about third, fourth generation Australians. You go into high schools and principals will tell you that some children have managed to get through their primary years and they start in high school with a year three reading level. These are the key challenges in our education system. Now, those children are mostly in government schools, but many are also in some of the poorer Catholic schools. And as I say, we have put a huge effort through national partnership investment into lifting achievement. My next research project, actually, at Melbourne University through the Graduate School of Education is to do a book that won't be as the size of this, but actually to gather together some of these stories, to look at schools and what it is they are doing, what they have in common, and how we get a system-wide lift, because that's what is eluding us at the moment. So I do not see it as an issue around the structure of our schooling system, but one of what is going on, particularly, as I say, in these poorer schools.
We've got plenty of questions. We've got a question here, then we go there, down the back.
Do you think it'd be possible that there is a way in which the ABC could have a wider range of viewpoints, particularly on political issues, such as the slush fund and so on, where you actually get great coverage from several viewpoints?
Ah, well, look, they need to have Jared on the insiders a lot more, obviously. You don't want to comment on this, Jared?
I didn't write the question.
So what slush fund are you referring to?
I think we were going to take questions on the topic.
Oh, right, okay, sort of okay.
Slightly off the topic.
I think across the range of ABC programming, television and radio, and online, I think there's more diversity than ever. I really do. Now, I have to say, I'm a bit of a dissatisfied consumer when it comes to some of the mid-evening programming. It's aimed for people under 30, that sort of kind of passed me by. But I think there's been a fabulous increase in Australian drama content recently, and on very contemporary themes. I think the national broadcast is punching out.
There's a question here.
You half answered the question, Maxine, but I was going to ask you, have you any idea why those results are patchy that you were talking about?
I have read any number of reports that go back 10, 15 years. You can actually go all the way back to Peter Carmel. We don't learn from success. And this is what I want to do, to write, an accessible piece that will show, if you've got a school there and over there and over there that are doing it, why aren't the ones there and there doing it? And can you put teams of people into those schools to actually say, well, look, this is how you organise your professional learning. This is what you do inside the classroom and all the rest of it. Because I wouldn't say a formula, but as I say, any number of top flight educators have put this material together and looked at what is going on in the schools. It can be done. I'll just give you an example. The Grattan Institute did a marvellous thing last year. Ben Jensen brought together the equivalent of the director generals from some of the East Asia and North Asia countries. There was a bloke out from Shanghai who runs the Shanghai system. Imagine that's almost the size of Australia, right? Mm-hmm. And they have their own equity problems, because there's any number of families coming in from the rural countryside, where, you know, educational levels are very different. And what they do with their lead schools, with their high achievement schools, they are contracted on a commercial basis to work with other schools where there's poor performance, and they actually take teams of people into those schools to work on every level to say this is how it is done. Quite now, some jurisdictions in this country are doing something similar. Equally, some of the universities, QUT in Queensland, Melbourne University, they're going out of their way to get their best Master of Teaching graduates into the most disadvantaged schools. And I know in Queensland they're getting them into Cape York, and those principals up there are calling back to Brisbane and saying, give us more, give us more. They are highly motivated teachers who are absolutely determined to say, you will achieve to a 10-year-old. Failure's not an option.
No, we've got to move on because...
Hang on, just a quick one.
I thought you were talking about the results being patchy with the National Partnership Program, which I believe they were.
Oh, I see, you mean talking about NAPLAN. I'm not talking about NAPLAN results.
NAPLAN.
No, but...
Oh, sorry.
I'll talk to you a bit later. Okay.
Thanks.
Sorry.
Right down the back. Yeah, that's you. Yep. Yes.
I'd like to... I wonder if you can throw some light on why the Labor Party is wasting their time refuting what Tony Abbott, all the nonsense that he sprouts, instead of using their time to show what the Labor Party has done, what laws they have passed in this short period, and where they're going, and explaining things like the National Broadband Network.
Yes. Yeah, well, look, I would agree with you. Why do they keep doing it? Because they certainly think it works. And as I know, I mean, you know, Tony Abbott's own personal approval ratings are quite low. In fact, did I read the other day they're low? His net approval rating is lower than Malcolm Turnbull's was. When he was opposition leader. They're doing because it's work, and I assume they'll keep on doing it. I find it tedious. I have never known a government to talk as much as it does about the other side. Never known a time when they constantly reference the leader on the other side. But I know what I'm looking for, what I assume most of you are looking for, and that's a coherent story from the government about its own achievements and the ambitions that it has for the country. And, you know, along the way, yes, you know, let's have the, you know, the. But we think this guy is lacking. We respond, I'll give you, I worked in the early childhood portfolio for the first 15 months. The other day, Tony Abbott did a perfectly sensible thing, said he's going to have a Productivity Commission inquiry into childcare. I thought it had some limitations, but nobody actually mentioned the child in all of this. Bit of a miss, but anyway. We responded by saying, certainly the grab I saw on the news was to say, this is just another slogan from Tony Abbott. Well, given that this is a significant issue, we've put huge money into it, $4.5 billion a year in subsidies in that rebate and the benefit. It's worth a bit more than that, and it's worth also saying, well, Tony, you're a bit late. This is what we've done. You know.
There's a question up the back. Yes.
You said that you hold out some hope for the change in discourse, which is great, but what actually gives you that hope that we're going to actually have a sensible political discussion? We can all gather in a room.
Yes.
Like this. I actually don't see it when I look beyond almost like-minded people, and that's come across very badly, but hopefully...
Yes. What's the evidence? Well, as I say, I look at the at many of the people in the Parliament, and I know that they would be... As I say, as frustrated, you know, as I've expressed to you, I've got the liberty to be more vocal about it. But did some of you see Q&A the other night? Mm-hmm. That was clear. The response to that, I mean, again, I would only give it about a 6 out of 10 because neither Rudd or Turnbull actually got down to saying actually how they would repair the tax base. But they had a go and it was a serious effort. And people responded to... the way they clearly had a bit of time for each other. And it told me that, as I say, that there is an appetite for this. Sooner or later, you would have to think that the senior members of our leaders, the senior members of the political class, will get the message. We have flashes of it. The Prime Minister's announcement of the Asian Century White Paper was a very good speech. And the question she took after that at the Lowy Institute, you know, showed a very considerable breadth of understanding and the importance of this to her. Going back a bit further, again, at the National Press Club a while back, when the Prime Minister talked about the importance of the Gonski Review, and again, the questions and answers that followed that, very, very considerable discussion. But I just see them as kind of one-offs. And we, you know, so much out there, and it flashes by, and we think, ooh, what was that? And we don't seem to get back to these things. Right at the end of the book, I actually say perhaps there should be a new rule, and that is less is more. That actually, and now Tony Abbott's not going to do this because he's running from opposition, that if there's less daily commentary from our leaders on everything, and John Howard perfected this, you'd have to say, you know, six times a day would be nothing for the former PM to be out there talking about the cricket, the weather, you name it, everything that was going, and we continued that. Well, I think now in an age of instant messaging, when every student and every retiree and everyone in between is on Twitter and Facebook and all the rest of it, it doesn't make any sense for the political class to run into this crowded space. So I actually think a little bit, I won't say strategic retreat, but more carefully measured pronouncements every couple of days or perhaps every week, so that when the Prime Minister and others do speak, people might say, hey, so there's something serious about this, and it will lend a sense of gravitas to it.
Right, there's a question. We're going to be quick now, because we're going right down the back and then over here. Yeah. Yes.
You've mentioned that in your campaign that you weren't able to express your views. My question is that to avoid what Winston Churchill said, terminological inexactitude, that whether you're left or right, both totalitarianism. My question is that is what on the spectrum of up or down, whether your political philosophy is up to the individual freedom of the individual system of law and order, or it's more down to a lot of welfare, a lot of government control of the individual. So from that spectrum, up or down, I'm trying to find out your political philosophy.
I think the question is, are you a maker or are you a taker? I think that's the question.
Okay. Now, look, I certainly always, in terms of my conversation with my electorate, I always felt, and as I did, I didn't feel particularly constrained at all about sharing with them my beliefs. But if there was any point at which that converged, if you like, the party view, I would make that clear. I remember lots of conversations, for instance, about, I remember some conversations about gay marriage in the early days of the government. And, you know, I expressed my own views to constituents, but made clear what the government's positioning was. So, no, I never felt constrained in that sense.
Next question here.
Look, I have to say this comes up at every event. What were yours? Okay. Look, I have a slightly different view, and when I looked at that and viewed it again, I actually thought that the Prime Minister responded with the visceral fury that she did. I think almost because of the crassness of what Tony Abbott had said in the lead up to that, which was a reference to the Alan Jones comment about her father. And I just saw that as her, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it from you anymore. I really saw it in that context rather than this issue of gender. But I know a lot of people do not agree with that. But I have to say, that being the case, and it is certainly something that absolutely cut through the greyness and the choreographed, way that we tend to talk. Young people mention it to me all the time. It's quite interesting.
In fairness to Tony Abbott, he didn't mention the Prime Minister's father.
No.
He used the term about the
that's
government.
That's right. But as I say, I must admit, I would find it extremely tedious if every statement is now going to be put through the gender kind of filter.
Okay. Okay, so we're going to go 1, 2, and 3. Yeah. We've got to be quick.
It seems to me, Maxine, that almost everything that you referred to would be answered by satisfactory levels of leadership in this country. And I believe that what is happening is that we unfortunately have two leaders who, in the business parlance, if you were evaluating them, they would be number two rather than number one. They could be very effective, very intelligent, whatever, but they are operational delivery type people, etc., as we know in business. Now, both the Prime Minister and Tony Abbott both suffer from this fact of being unable to engage in terms of vision presentation of what we're all about.
Okay, we've got to be quick.
My question is, in 5 years' time, who do you believe will be leading? Who would you like to see leading
Well, I can't even think ahead for 5 minutes. No, 5 years. I don't know. I just do not know. But I know there are a lot of people in that parliament with leadership skills. They have what it takes to go all the way. But you know what I regard as when I think back on what I've been writing about, the great pity is that Rudd and Gillard were a very good team. They were very complimentary people right through the campaign of 2007, through 2008, and through most of 2009. Julia is a very, very effective, able administrator. Starts work every day knowing exactly what she wants to achieve and has a clear plan of how she will do that. And it's why, actually, the civil service responds to her very positively. Rudd is a genuine intellectual. He loves the free flow of ideas, and he can start the day with 10 ideas, and he needs a chief of staff who would say two of those are goers, and we'll work on the first one, right? And actually there was nothing, but, you know, I will go for, I want that breadth. And again, you think back to what we've achieved here, 5% unemployment, not 8% unemployment like, the United States. Ken Henry credits Rudd with having the intellectual grasp right at the beginning of 2008. So we came in, we've had the collapse of Bear Stearns, the collapse of Lehman Brothers is ahead of us, but right at the beginning of 2008, it's Rudd who's saying to Ken Henry, what's the worst that can happen here? You know what an effective CEO has to do? What's the real risk here? What's the absolute worst that could hit a nation like Australia? And as Henry says, it was Rudd who really pushed Treasury. Well, that is what you want. But as I say, I think it is a great pity. There were other options, in my view, that could have been taken in 2010. People had other choices they could have made, and that didn't happen.
It'll be very quick, yes.
What are your thoughts on Julia Gillard coming out with the Asian paper on a Sunday, on the same weekend that the book was publicised in the Sydney Morning Herald?
Pure coincidence, I imagine.
And there was a final question here. Yeah.
What's the political path back for the restoration of research funding for universities?
Yes, very good question. Constant lobbying. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just this as I say, the disappointment. The universities, as you know, had lobbied so hard for that. This co-contribution, and it was to start at, I think, low scale, and it was to go up year by year to point where it would be a 50% contribution to what the universities put in, and these are the on costs to support the ARC grants for research. And as I work with Glyn Davis now, the Vice Chancellor of Melbourne University, as he said, we're punching out as never before, but that's because of this huge effort that's gone into research. That in turn is what drives your global ranking, and that in turn, as I say, is what attracts the top talent, who are then able to work with other bright people in Australia, and you get the innovation that drives your future economic progress and productivity. So, as I say, not a smart decision.
A final quick question. What does a Vice Chancellor's Fellow do apart from writing books?
Well, you get invited to lovely things like this. You get invited to be, part of the discourse of the university. And as I say, I'm in the Graduate School of Education with these, first-class researchers like John Hattie and Richard Teese and Colette Taylor. So I'm going to be basically picking their brains. I don't have anything like an academic background, but I'm just going to bring my journalistic skills to what is, I think, quite a passion for me and such an important issue.
Many thanks.
Thank you, Jared.
So as I said, Janet Grundy's got some copies of Tales from the Political Trenches. Maxine McHugh spoke about her political journalistic skills. She certainly has a lot of them, and we've seen them in evidence tonight. She also had a lot of political skills. She won a seat that a lot of people didn't think she would win, and now she's working around a university. Look, I'm very pleased that Ms. McHugh could make it here tonight to talk about her book. It clearly has been an influential book. It's done what many books don't do. It started a lot of people talking, and that's obviously a good thing, and we've seen more of that tonight. We could go on forever, but it's 7 o'clock and we're not. I just want to say many thanks to Maxine McHugh and good luck with the book. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.